If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Hi, Patrick. How are you doing today?
Good, Karen. How are you?
It's so exciting to have you. Now, you'll hear Patrick. He's on Let's Get Legal with John Hansen. He's got his own podcast now called Sidebar. And we're going to talk a little bit about where you can hear that and what you're going to be covering. But just so you know, Patrick's background, he's practiced in employment and business law for executives and companies since he began his legal career many decades ago, I think over two. He represents executives nationwide in matters involving harassment, discrimination, retaliation. He negotiates compensation agreements and restrictive covenants and those types of things. If you ever have a question, he's the one to ask. Let's get started with some really interesting news story this week. And I want to talk about the Illinois cell phone ban in school. And this is interesting because I wouldn't have thought that many states passed one of these, but that's not the case.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of them already have.
Yeah.
And Illinois, I guess it passed the Senate. The governor says he's going to sign it. And I think there's a lot of good stuff there. The law is a little bit different for kids who are K through 8 versus those in high school, but I think it addresses an important issue, which is distraction. How are kids paying attention in school? Are they spending too much time on their phone? Does that distract other kids and the teachers, et cetera? So we can talk about the exceptions, which I think are, you know, very importantly placed on things like safety, kids who need like employment, assistance with different academic issues, et cetera. So I think, I think that's a really good idea. I have three kids who are all gone through the elementary high school age thing. And I think that would have been a good idea, back when they were at that age.
Yeah. And it's gotten even, you know, more pervasive that kids are not only on their phone during school, but they're at night and in the morning and they just don't have a break from it. And some of the preliminary studies that I've read show that when they have their phones removed in school, they do better in school. It's not a huge change, but it's a marginal change, and any change is good into the positive. Also bullying, I think, is a problem. And I don't know about you, but bullying to me was on the schoolyard. You know, we didn't have the ability to do it all the time with our phones and do it in a way that's anonymous or that way that's kind of passive aggressive. So I think that's going to probably help out that situation, which is a crisis.
It is a crisis. And also we have, improper photos and videos being shared. And at the high school level, the thing that you don't need running through school, especially during class time, are those sorts of things. You don't need them at any point, but that is a serious distraction, and it could cause, you know, a lot of issues between students. So I think it's a great idea. The governor will sign it. The exceptions have to do with, you know, managing a child's health issues.
Yes.
If there are emergencies, they can get to their phone. In high school, I think the law will provide that the high schoolers can have it over the lunchtime and during breaks, so when they're between classes, but they cannot use it at all during class. In K through 8, they can't use it at all. So I think those are realistic guidelines for kids.
And the enforcement is interesting because it's not strong enforcement, is my understanding.
It's not. I guess you can't discipline, you can't suspend, you can't kick kids out of school for violating it. There are no fines that can be imposed, et cetera. But I think if that policy stands and that policy is, you know, made known to the students, made known to the parents, made known to the teachers, I think you'll see a lot of good stuff come of it, despite the fact that the, you know, enforcement mechanisms don't seem to be there.
Do you see any challenges to it, like, you know, First Amendment? I mean, are there going to be parents? And frankly, if you guys have any comments about this, 312-981-7200, are there any parents out there who do not like this rule? I assume that most parents are going to say that's probably a good thing. Get the kids off the devices, at least for the time they're supposed to be learning things in school. But if you have an objection, I'd like to know what it is. 312-981-7200. 7200. What do you think about a First Amendment or due process type of argument that kids have a right to talk, kids have a right to communicate? What do you think? Is that going anywhere, that argument?
Well, and remember, First Amendment's only going to protect those kids, or frankly, maybe even those parents, who are in public schools.
Right.
The First Amendment does not protect any kind of private setting for a school, or frankly, anywhere else, in a company, an employment situation, et cetera. So I don't, you know, there are those sorts of issues that will be raised. I think the courts are not going to trump these policies with the First Amendment argument. I think the exceptions, which are good exceptions, along with the rule that, you know, addresses some serious concerns in the school, I think the law will be upheld despite legal challenges.
I agree. And, you know, I think that what listeners should know is that kids have constitutional rights.
They do.
Definitely do. But the law has been very clear all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court that schools can do things, can lessen those constitutional rights or infringe on them a little bit in order to keep the order in school, in order to facilitate the learning process. And if something is interfering with that, the courts are going to uphold it because that's in their best interest, because they are minors.
Right, they will. And also, there's a safety issue. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, a lot of bad stuff can come from kids texting and sending messages, you know, to each other during the day. Things can escalate. You can have a lot of altercations as a result of it. So there, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning, a lot of states already have these policies, and which was a surprise to me too. I didn't know that. And so I think legal challenges have not struck those down.
We're talking about the cell phone ban in Illinois schools, and I have a texter who said the only objective is no way to enforce it. When these kids find out there's no consequences, the inmates are going to be running the asylum. And why do you think, Patrick, there is no enforcement mechanism? In fact, there's not that there's not an enforcement mechanism. There can be no enforcement mechanism. That is specifically in the law.
I think it's because what they're trying to do is avoid a mechanism for a ton of litigation. Okay. And they're trying to avoid any arguments about discrimination as far as how that's applied.
Yes.
So both of those issues are big issues that schools don't want to deal with. Frankly, they have enough things to worry about in terms of disciplining kids for a whole bunch of different things. It's already taking time away from faculty, administration, et cetera, to work through all those issues. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just trying to answer the caller. I don't think they want to hand students another way to litigate issues and kind of tie up the whole school system with that.
Absolutely. I think that's actually the best answer here. Donna, let's quickly go to you. Hi, Donna. You have a question about this cell phone ban.
I do, and it's one for safety. In the event that a plug ugly invades the school and the kids' phones are all locked up and inaccessible, who calls the cops?
Well, I think, you know, I think that's an issue that the parents are going to raise. And I think if there's going to be an objection with this law, it's going to be that, you know, that there should be the ability of a child to call 911 if there's a school shooting or an intruder or something violent going on. But again, you know, there must have been a weighing of those things. How often does that happen? How likely is that? How important is it for a child to be able to do that versus having the whole school, you know, be better focused in what they're doing? But thank you for raising that. I agree with you that that is going to be a concern with many, many parents. Thank you, Donna. Thanks for bringing that up. Let's go to the next news story. Patrick, we got a few to talk about here. Ryan Sandberg is in the news. His children are suing his widow. Children from the first marriage, I believe, they're suing their stepmother. Can you just tell us briefly what the basis of this lawsuit is?
Well, I think what they're alleging is that, and they, I mean, the children of Ryan Sandberg from his first marriage are alleging that his wife and her two children are improperly changed the assets of the trust to go to them. Okay. And they were cut out of the process in determining how Ryan Sandberg's assets would be distributed. They were supposed, they meaning Ryan Sandberg's widow, his second wife, and Ryan Sandberg's children were supposed to set up a trust. That never happened. The trust was not set up. In that trust, they were supposed to, quote, work together. Those were Ryan Sandberg's words. Work together to determine how the assets would be distributed. Years go by. The trust doesn't get established. So we don't have, and you know, there's no mechanism through which these decisions can be made. Then later on, right before Ryan Sandberg dies, that trust is changed so that his wife and her children, you know, before Ryan Sandberg's marriage, they now control what the trust is and the device is created. I believe that's what happened. So now you've got, you know, folks who are alleging that the trust was, you know, should have been set up. It wasn't set up on purpose by Ryan Sandberg's widow, and she exerted undue influence over him to change how the trust assets would be distributed, really thereby cutting out his two children.
Ah, and, you know, he died in July of 2025 at the age of 65. And undue influence, can you just explain to our listeners a little bit what that means?
Sure. So in order to adhere to a contract or enter into a contract, you have to be in a knowing and voluntary state of mind. In other words, you have to clearly understand what you're doing, or the agreement is not enforceable if you're not in your right mind. So undue influence happens where a party to the agreement, or someone who benefits from the agreement, will convince the person who has signed an agreement to change what they're doing. And the state of mind of the person who's changing the contract, that's at issue. So if they're incapacitated in any way mentally, then the influence of that outside party to get them to do something may not be upheld if the person is not thinking clearly. That's undue influence. You're taking advantage of their deficient state of mind.
And, you know, in the area of trust and estate planning and probate and all of that, you know, it's a very perilous thing, because I've seen cases, and Patrick, I was involved in one where an elderly couple didn't really have children in the area, and the children really weren't very interested in helping their parents, unfortunately. So a neighbor who had been there for them for 30, 40 years took them in a car, got them an attorney, sat in the waiting room while they went in there, and they changed their will, and they left a bunch of money to the neighbor. And then there was a lawsuit for undue influence. And the court found that there was undue influence, because the neighbor actually chose the lawyer and brought the couple there. And it seemed to me that it was pretty innocuous. It was pretty much the person was doing a good thing for the couple, and certainly wasn't doing it to glom onto the estate. And he claimed that he didn't even know they were going to do that. So you got to be really careful when you take your parents to a lawyer. You can't be there, you know, basically in the room, advocating that you become the beneficiary and to the exclusion of your other siblings, etc. So it's something to really be worried about.
Yeah, and I think it's totally understandable, because that, you know, the person who's changing that decision, if they're in a vulnerable place, you know, the court is just not going to uphold that decision. But also, the court is really concerned about the original contract and enforcing the original contract. That's the preference of any court. And so you have to have really solid evidence, facts, and terms for that to be changed. And so I get it. I mean, in that case, Karen, listen, it might have been for a completely innocuous reason. And, you know, they might have helped this person for decades and expected nothing. And so why should they be punished when, you know, the person who holds the trust assets decides, hey, I really like you, I don't even talk to my kids, I want to change these assets. The problem is, even if you do it the quote unquote correct way, a court may say, hey, we just don't look at it that way. This is fraught with danger, and we're just not going to uphold the change.
You know, the moral of the story here for me with this Ryan Sandberg case is that, you know, again, Monday morning quarterbacking, and I don't know who the lawyers were, and I don't know exactly what the wording was, because we're not privy to it, but gosh, wouldn't this have been better off just nailed down right when, you know, early on before he got sick, you know, so that you leave it to the family members to work it out, to work something out? That sounds like a disaster. And, you know, as we see this, when there is a death in the family, mm-hmm. and the siblings come to the table, you think they're going to behave themselves, but they don't always, right? They don't always act honorably, and they don't always act in the best interest of the person who's deceased. So.
And now, and then in that instance, Karen, looking back, the kids are like, well, why did his widow drag her feet for so long?
Yes.
We really wanted her to get that trust, signed, sealed, and delivered, just like, our dad wanted. It just didn't happen. And then now, at the end, she's using that in her favor. So it's a mess.
It's a real mess. And, this could go for a long period of time.
I bet it will.
And, because there's rights to his name, and I'm sure there's merchandise
yes.
still being sold and all kinds of things that are going to be an ongoing source of pain for this family.
For sure.
We can talk about some of these other stories, but I have a funny little story that
sure.
I don't know why this is visual. It's out of Fremont, California. It's a bizarre road rage incident. Two people are, one's tailing, the other one, they're probably flipping each other off, right? They finally pull off, which is something you should never do, to fight, of course. I'm thinking these are men. There's a lot of testosterone
okay.
going on here. They throw punches, and then one of them takes out a ukulele and hits the other guy over the head with it. And this is aggravated battery. They're investigating this. What do we make of this?
I don't know. Should we be sad that the world is one less ukulele? I'm not sure we should be sad about that.
I wonder if this is a part of like a string of violence.
Yeah, violence. That's cute. That's
yeah. Cool. Well.
Yeah. I don't know. I would say only in California, but no, not only in California. They just have a lot more drivers, so maybe it happens more often. But I think a lot of people, I find ukuleles kind of annoying to
yes,
listen to.
Yes, I think most people do.
But I did go to, an Eddie Vedder concert, and he played the ukulele, and it sounded great.
It sounded great. So you can make it sound
yes.
good. Patrick Dolan, my law partner, he practices in the area of employment and business law. And what you do a lot of, Patrick, I listen to you through the walls.
Sorry.
Yeah, well.
Sorry about
it
that.
It gets a little heated sometimes. But, you do a lot of negotiation.
I do.
You do a lot of mediation. But you also are negotiating severance packages for people who are leaving. You are negotiating restrictive covenants. You're negotiating business deals. And I think that, it's really an underrated skill because it helps when, to be a good negotiator when you're a lawyer, for sure, because everything's a negotiation. But in life, everything's a negotiation, right? I mean, your spouse, who takes out the garbage, your kids, negotiating, curfew times, your boss, asking for a raise. I mean, these are things that you have to address every day of your life. And how can you give our listeners some tips on negotiation in general?
Yeah, so you're right. I've been doing this. At the beginning of the show, you said like 2 decades. Thanks, Karen. It's more like 3 decades.
Well,
thank
I guess
you for
I
that.
Should round up, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of what I do is negotiation. And here's, after doing this for so long for clients, I think a couple things are takeaways. One is you have to listen really closely to what your client wants, what their goals are. And then you have to determine whether those are achievable. Okay. And sometimes there's some education about the law, what the law allows, what it doesn't allow, what a judge or a jury is going to do or not going to do with that set of facts in terms of, what this person wants. And then you have to set expectations. So I think a lot of negotiation is taking what your client wants and determining whether that's an achievable goal, and then translating that into, okay, how do I get there? And then when you present that, those goals to the other side, actually listen to what they have to say in response. But I think the key is setting expectations, listening to what your client wants or what your spouse wants or what your kids want or whoever you're talking to, and think, because sometimes these things, just sort of come out of your mouth instantly about whether that's a good idea, a bad idea, whatever. Just think about how you can get there. And if you can't, explain why. Reasonably and rationally, why you don't think so. And so I think a lot of it is listening and figuring out how to get what the person wants. And if it's not achievable, figure out what the best alternative is.
And I think that's a really, really good point. And I also think a lot of people get very excited and emotional, and they don't prepare for a negotiation. They don't think ahead what might happen. What might that person say? What might that person do? What Where is this going to go if we don't resolve it? If my spouse won't take out the garbage on Mondays, yeah. then what's going to happen? Then I'll do it, or are we going to hire someone to do it? I'm using that as a loose example, but you have to kind of know and plan for it, because it's more like a chess game than an emotional pinball game. And I think if you get agitated and upset, if your boss says, "I really can't give you a raise this year," you know, and you have to have plan B. You know, you have to have plan B. Am I willing to leave? Am I willing to, would you take fewer hours? Maybe I can spend more time with my kids if you're not going to give me a raise. Or can I work remotely one day a week in exchange for a raise? You know, having these alternative suggestions so that you don't walk away, you know, with nothing in your pocket.
Yeah, and I think you and I have the same experience in that we've been down that road, in different roads, many times. And so we can say, listen, if we don't work this out, settle this claim, this is the road we're going to have to go down.
Yep.
We have to file a lawsuit. We have to file a charge. We have to file a claim. And this is what that's going to look like, to show them what the alternative is. And then that sends to level set with a lot of folks about, well, maybe, you know, I'm not getting $1 million, getting a lot less than $1 million doesn't sound so bad, because the alternatives are actually quite a bit worse for me monetarily, my time, my stress, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think listening and trying to figure out what the person is telling you and what's achievable in terms of what they want is a huge part of negotiation. And then couching it so that the other side, you know, may be able to reach that too. That's a big part of it.
And putting yourself in someone else's shoes. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, what is my kid thinking? My kid is thinking he wants to be out till midnight. I'm thinking no. and so what is it that I can add to this mix to get, you know, I'm saying with kids, maybe you don't negotiate as much as you tell them what to do, but you know, you kind of put yourself in the other person's shoes to understand where they're coming from. But let's just get to Phil, who's got a question about class actions. Hi, Phil. Welcome to WGN.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I just got a card from the United States District Court about Massachusetts about a court-approved legal notice. The company that we're going after is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My point is, I'm just trying to find out. I was involved with purchasing something when I was in the hospital, and it cost me a bundle. It cost my insurance company a bundle. They paid their part, and I finally paid. Is it worth going into getting involved in a class action suit? Because they said there's two different ways. There's a long thing, WW Hart device settlement, or I can go with a pro rata settlement. Mm. And I was just wondering, it cost me $500. Is it worth? I don't really have to put any kind of personal information. So is it just send it in and see what happens?
That's a good question, because we get these all the time.
All the time.
Different people get. Patrick, why don't you give him an answer?
Yeah, so you're going to get in. You're going to get that notice off and on. A lot of folks do. And it's really asking you whether you want to quote opt in or really be a part of a class action lawsuit. Or if you want to opt out, not be a part, and then sue on your own. You know, the way I look at this is, if you don't plan to sue on your own, which oftentimes is not a great way to go at all, especially if the company's bankrupt or et cetera, then why not? Why not opt in? Listen, you're going to get, you know, pennies on the dollar, but it's better than nothing. And so what I tell people is, unless you are certain that you're going to sue outside of this class action, and unless you are certain you're going to win and get a bunch of money, go ahead and opt in and see what you can get.
Yeah, and usually there's really no participation. There's no money up front. There's no,
nothing.
You know, you don't pay for anything, so you'll get the notices, and at some point, hopefully you'll get a check. And I will say this, you know, I don't know exactly how much you lost. Did you say it was $500? I'm not sure, but for $500, you're not going to hire a lawyer, because to file the lawsuit costs more than that, let alone attorney's fees, which could be in excess of $150,000 to $200,000. So your only real option to get any recovery was going to be this class action suit. Now, you know, looking at you told me there were two different options, the long way and the short way. I really can't address that, because we don't have the paperwork in front of us. But, you know, it could be that there's a phone number there that you can maybe reach out and talk to someone. That's sometimes hard, because class actions by their very nature are numerous people, and it may be the lawyers aren't set up for answering phone calls like this. Patrick, any other?
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, lawyers probably won't take your case anyway, because if there's an existing class action, it's just so much more cumbersome to sue outside of that class action. I think you're going to have a really hard time even finding a lawyer to take your case.
I hope we answered your question, Phil. Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think it's something that a lot of people they ask that question quite a bit. Patrick, you are a soccer super fan.
Huge.
I know that. And I will, you know, what? Tell us what is going on. When does it start? What is going on? Where is it being held for those of us who are not big soccer fans? And what are some of the legal issues that you see that are going to arise?
Yeah, so the World Cup starts on June 11th. It'll go to June 19th. It's in three different countries, which is unusual. It's not usually how it goes.
No.
Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Various cities are hosting World Cup games over that roughly 5-week period. There are 48 nations. They've already been decided. They've already been pooled into different groups. They know who they're playing. There are many different sites in the States, unfortunately not Chicago.
No, I can't.
Which, you know, which a lot of people are pretty upset about, me included. I went to the game yesterday. USA played Germany in the last men's international friendly, as they call them, Karen, before the World Cup. It was phenomenal. Soldier Field was sold out, 63,000 plus. The fans were really, really into it, which is good to see, because soccer doesn't get a lot of excitement, especially as compared to a lot of other countries around the world where soccer is the sport.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to see folks sort of, you know, becoming into it now that World Cup is about to start. But you know, it's not all good news. There's been a lot of, folks who are upset about the price of tickets to these World Cup games, not just in the States, but in Canada and Mexico. Access to tickets, really hard. Karen, prices are ridiculous. I mean, I was looking at, you know, going to a couple of games. They're in the thousands of dollars per ticket. And FIFA, which is the governing body for World Cup soccer and just sort of soccer internationally generally, has tried to do something about this. I think they've been unsuccessful in trying to get those prices down. But the something we have in this country that, you know, Canada and Mexico doesn't have, we actually have travel bans in place that affect certain countries who are coming to the World Cup playing in the States. It doesn't affect the teams in terms of the players, the staff, etc., but it's going to affect the fans who are coming from some of these countries. There are a handful that straight up have travel bans, who just can't come to the U.S. Those include Haiti, Iran, the Ivory Coast, and Senegal. They're straight up travel bans. I don't, you know, it's going to be kind of weird, Karen, because their teams are going to be playing in World Cup games in the States, and they won't really have fans. Now, family members probably will be able to come, but you know, the way things are right now, they're generally not going to be able to come to the States and see their teams play. And there are other countries too that have very, not maybe not total travel bans, but very limited access to coming into this country. So it's sort of a mess, to be honest, as to what's going to happen. And there are a lot of folks in this country who have actually been expelled recently, for example, from Haiti, who maybe, you know, they're already here and they would have gone to a match. They're not here anymore. So, you know, it's just a mess as far as getting people here. And I'm 60 years old. I've seen a lot of World Cups. I've never seen fans from certain countries banned from going to the World Cup game wherever it's being held. So it's really unusual. It's, you know, I think pretty sad.
Yeah,
because the World Cup is a big deal in a lot of countries.
And, you know, I like to use current events to kind of warn people and kind of give advice as to the bigger picture. And well, this makes me think about travel in general. And you and I are both heavy-duty travelers. We like to go to places that are out of the way.
Yeah.
And sometimes they present challenges. And one of the things that I always tell people is, when you travel to a foreign country, whether you're going to a World Cup game or whether you're going on vacation or whatever you're doing, is you need to really understand what the laws are there, because
For sure.
You'd be surprised at what places to ban certain things. You know, for instance, a lot of people think that Mexico is loose when it comes to marijuana laws. Not so much. You know, you can be arrested and prosecuted in Mexico for possessing marijuana, and you don't want to be in a Mexican jail with no rights. And so the other things, you know, certain countries you can't wear camouflage. That's against the law to wear camouflage for one reason or another. So again, like, know the laws, and you can go on these, you know, embassy websites and know, like, what's going on in that country. What would happen if you had an accident? What would happen if someone goes missing? What would happen if you're injured? You know, to be able to have those numbers readily available, because the embassy is going to be your contact point there.
Yeah. And back to the World Cup, I'm just super excited that it's here. I mean, it hasn't been here for a long time. You know, we should be gracious hosts and allow everybody to come in and cheer on their team. And I think that's really unfortunate. I don't know ultimately who's going to be let in and who's not. I just know these travel bans are affecting a lot of folks, and I think a lot of folks aren't even trying to come in. They may go to Canada to see a show, to see a game. They may go to Mexico to see a game, but that doesn't mean their teams are going to be playing there. So I think it's pretty difficult.
Yeah, yeah, it's unfortunate. Let's just quickly talk about the Supreme Court case that has to do another sporting case. It's Brian Flores, who was the former Dolphins head coach. He's I think he's now the Vikings defensive coordinator. He sued the NFL along with several other people. It's a class action suit. Basically, the allegations are that minorities and African Americans are being discriminated against in holding coaching positions, that the NFL will, yes, they will interview minorities, but then they do it just as a kind of a facade, and then go ahead and hire somebody who's white. And so the case has been on the books for a while. It made it to the Supreme Court on kind of a niche topic. Can you tell us just briefly what the topic was and what is next for that lawsuit?
Yeah, so the topic is arbitration and whether folks like Brian Flores must arbitrate their claims. He filed a race discrimination claim, as well as a couple other coaches. It proceeded, and the court ruled that he does not need to arbitrate the case. That's a court of appeals in New York. The Supreme Court decided not to look at that issue, so that's the rule for that case. And arbitration's interesting because, Karen, as you know, it eliminates the possibility of going to court. You have to go to a private arbitrator. They decide, etc. The problem in this case is that the decision-making entity in that arbitration was the NFL. And so,
which,
that's a problem.
I mean,
because the arbitrator is supposed to be a neutral,
right,
selected by both parties, someone you can agree on. You and I do a lot of mediations, arbitrations.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of effort to find a neutral mediator. But the court's like, wait a minute. This is not a neutral mediator. This is not a process that Brian Flores should have to go through, because it's just not fair.
Well, look at it. I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense. I'm saying that you, NFL, discriminated against me because of the color of my skin, and you're going to decide what? You're going to decide if I discriminated against you?
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't seem pretty counterintuitive.
But, I mean, had the NFL had a provision for arbitration that allowed for a third-party arbitrator, there are professional arbitrators out there all over Chicago, New York, all over, who are very seasoned, and they may even have really good experience in these kinds of cases,
for
whether
sure.
It's NFL or discrimination in nature. And if they had done it that way, it might have been upheld, because it seems like the courts are upholding these arbitration agreements.
Yeah, I would say they are, generally speaking, in employment matters. Karen, I know people get really upset sometimes about arbitration and being forced to go to arbitration as opposed to filing a lawsuit you can get in front of a jury. But courts uphold arbitration clauses by and large in employment matters.
And I just had a texter, the Rooney Rule is a joke. Can you explain what the Rooney Rule is?
Yeah, really quick. The Rooney Rule says that you have to interview a couple different minority candidates for job openings, like head coach and a coordinator, a quarterback's coach. You have to interview minority candidates. And recently that's included women. And, you know, folks have been challenging that up and down and saying, okay, it really is just a check the box. Now, you're not really considering these folks for these positions.
So now what happens with the case? It proceeds to a jury trial.
Yeah, he doesn't have to arbitrate. This case is going through the litigation system to a jury trial.
And I'm just curious, what do you think? Do you think the case is going to settle? And if it does, what kind of terms would there possibly be? I mean, obviously money it would be exchanged, but would there be some sort of protocol for moving forward to have quotas? Because I think that would be unconstitutional, probably.
You know what's really interesting, Karen, is that the Florida Attorney General is investigating is anticipated to be filing a lawsuit challenging the Rooney Rule. And so that may be, to answer your question, in a slightly different way, not the Flores case, but the Florida AG's office may ultimately win in that litigation and terminate that Rooney Rule.
Oh, that's, we're going that way. Patrick Dolan, we got a minute.
Sure.
Tell everyone what your practice is and how to get in touch with you.
So, I'm a workplace lawyer, essentially. If you have questions about your job, hiring, you were terminated, you think you were discriminated against, you have questions about your compensation, non-compete question, can I get this next job? If not, why not? And can you help me get it anyway? All those sorts of things. Anything to do with your job, I'm happy to help.
And you can give him a call at 312-332-7800.
Yeah, you know that number.
I do know that number. It sounds familiar. It's actually 312-FEAR-800, in case you want to know. Yeah, that was unintentional.
Why, did you pick that?
Yeah, I didn't. Okay. I didn't know that. Someone told me that many years after I had that phone number.
Well, we're not changing it now, Karen.
That's right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's been a great show. Patrick, thank you for joining us. I'll see you at the office
tomorrow.